It's January 18th, 2008, and this is 508, a show about Whistler.
There is audacity of an infusion of enthusiasm.
There is William Eddy of the Worcester City Council talking about how we need an infusion of enthusiasm for the City Square project. And this may not be possible, but this week we will be giving you an infusion of enthusiasm about the City of Worcester. Today on the show is once again Brendan Mellican. How are you doing?
Great, Mike. How are you?
I am doing great. I feel like we have a bajillion things on the list this week for stuff on the show. We have an interview with Pat Moriarty of WCUW coming up a little bit. This week I was down at the city council meeting, and I saw the Economic Development Initiatives report, as I guess what this thing is. And this is a really cool thing. Like, I had never seen one of these before, or if I saw it, I wasn't excited about it. To me, this is a report of what's the deal with that empty lot. You know, like, all these different things that are going on are in this, whether you're talking about downtown, Gateway Park, City Square, proposed completion 2015, according to this. And one thing that I saw on here that I thought was kind of cool, which I had not noticed before, was South Worcester Industrial Park. The city has reviewed the two proposals for 49 Canterbury Street and selected Pharmasphere LLC, a biopharmaceutical company that specializes in the cultivation of plants for the pharmaceutical industry. So that's kind of cool. Had you seen this before?
No, not at all.
And I was kind of thinking, like, I didn't know, you know, what are the plants for the pharmaceutical industry? I was thinking, are we talking about, like, ginseng or, you know, marijuana or what the heck is this? And it turns out, according to a Telegram and Gazette article, like, periwinkle and artemisia in stacks of plastic spheres.
I have nothing to add.
I don't know. There you go. It's called Pharmasphere. They don't have a website. According to this, the company has been around for about 8 months now. Yeah, or it was formed 8 months ago and uses technology and practices that were developed by TerraSphere Systems, LLC of Canada. So they don't really have a web presence. You know, I'm not really sure how big of a deal this is. But I don't know. Futuristic greenhouse, kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm done with that.
To me, of course, the most important development thing in the city is the Mason Winfield lot. This is a lot which is right next to the Catholic Worker on Mason Street. It used to be in institutional linens, and it was closed for a long time, and some hazardous issues with that lot. And groundbreaking on that site, or demolition on that site, started on Valentine's Day of 2006. After about a few months of the demolition, basically nothing happened on that lot for the next year and a half. And a couple of weeks ago, they started doing stuff again. They started basically digging a gigantic hole. It's going to eventually become some housing stuff. Wow, this says the new designs for 3-bedroom units rather than 2-bedroom units. Additional environmental assessments underway. EPA has approved a remediation plan for the site, which will enable a release of $170,000 pending a final budget submission by the developers. They first need to secure a mass development remediation loan. Anyhow, yeah, because this is a site which, you know, there's some issues with chemicals in the soil on this site. Anyhow, I'm just kind of excited to see that something, not only is something physically happening, but just to read, like, what's the deal with that vacant lot. It's kind of cool stuff, at least to me.
Absolutely.
Wayfinding Project. You want to talk about something I enjoyed at the city council meeting this week was that Gary Rosen stood up and was like, I saw this local blog, and, you know, I disagree with this guy. And it was apparently a reference to a Jeff Barnard Wormtown Taxi blog post that I'd missed before. And Jeff had basically said, you know what, the wayfinding thing, or like the pilot wayfinding thing is this thing in Federal Square that has a nice mosaic, and then it has a thing above it that says downtown that you can't read. And he just was like, you know what, you can't read this thing. And Gary Rosen's like, I don't care what people say, this is an awesome project. And I have to say, it isn't, like, I really like the mural. Like, the murals are beautiful. But I can give more anecdotal evidence that I walked by it a million times, so I knew that it said downtown. I figured that out eventually. First time I drove by, it was with a car full of people, and somebody said, oh, look at that. And then everybody's like, what does it say on that thing? As we're driving past it, a whole car full of people is trying to figure out what it says. So my assumption was that wayfinding was like an information design problem. It was like people come to the city, they want to know where they are, they want to know how to get around. We're going to have somebody who really understands like fonts and sign design and whatever, and it turns out it's really like a public art project. So I disagree with Gary Rosen. I just want to go on record as saying that.
You know, they've got a couple different, I don't know if you've seen the full presentation on that. I mean, there's a couple different levels of those, like, monoliths that they're putting out.
Okay.
And the really large ones that will end up going out sometime, I think will be more readable. And the one that's there now, I got the impression when I saw the presentation, it was more designed for, like, foot traffic.
Okay.
And being, like, a, you know, something that you could see from the distance while you're on your foot and know that there's going to be something like there to help you find your way around.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it was going to be like a replacement for, you know, like a street sign, so to speak.
Okay. So you're saying that you think that the next ones are going to be more helpful to people driving.
There's a whole series of these that'll be coming out, and some of them are kiosks that'll be like more interactive and informational. Some of there'll be smaller like monolith type structures that will be in some of the smaller like the neighborhoods of note that, you know, don't necessarily have, you know, just a marker, so to speak. And then there'll be really, really big, like, towers like that, from what I gather, on the outskirts of the city, kind of leading you into the city. It's a multi-level project that I think will make a little bit more sense if and when it actually happens.
That sounds great. I totally hope that's true. Like, Gary Rosen did not bring any of that stuff up, though. He was like, the sign is great. Don't diss the sign, people. And the sign is not... The sign, again, has good aspects. But, yeah, that sounds... You know, I mean, this says that the Wayfinding Initiative has been costed out at $2.3 million. So it's obviously much bigger than, just a couple of signs like that.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised that more people haven't seen the presentation that's circulating about it. And I know... You know, I'll send you a link to it because I think it's online somewhere. But it's the cultural... It's Aaron Williams has the presentation. And it's actually spectacular. I was under the impression that this was going to be a huge money sink when the Wayfinding Initiative first came out. And the more I've been exposed to it overall, it really makes a lot of sense. They've outsourced the design work to, you know, an industrial and corporate design company who really seems to know what they're doing. And I think they really get the idea that there are going to be multiple levels of, you know, these wayfinding markers.
Forward me that, and we'll put a link on the blog so that people can see that. And this, this also mentions that they have completed a GIS mapping of public parking locations downtown, which will be identified with markers. Which is another, that right there would be a great thing to have because nobody knows where to park when they come downtown to do something at my office. They're always like, it's just like you have to ask people where can I park. What are my options?
Yeah, you know, you go to Boston or something, you're used to seeing, or any big city, you're used to seeing those big blue signs with the white D on it. And around here, we've got, like, the curbside placards that, you know, fold out for the afternoon and, you know, little old man flagging you into somebody's driveway.
Yeah.
So you have parking space for $30.
Yeah, whatever's out there is not enough for the people who are driving around, so... I don't know. That's pretty much the economic... Anyway, I'm excited about the Economic Development Initiatives report, and as long as we continue doing this podcast, the next time one of these comes out, that'll just be like the focus of the podcast, I think, because it's just full of... It's full of actual information, you know, which is something that I totally like to find out about the city, and I feel like... I don't know. I feel like I don't get enough of it.
For the most part, you can't make that stuff up.
There you they try. Well, you bring up speaking of making up information,
like, there's actually going to be a building here, or there's actually, you know, this happening. It's something that, you know, you can't really make it up, so it's nice when these actual reports come up.
Well, speaking of making up information, you should bring up your issue with median income levels.
Well, it's also related to the Economic Development Office, because from what I can gather, these numbers have been coming out of that office. But I, for the last, I'd say, month or so, I've had a lot of people, and I love pointing out to people how low our median household income is in Worcester. Going back to the 2000 census, the federal government put us at around 35 and change for the median household income. Median family income being 42 and change, off the top of my head, back to 2000. And I really like pointing out to people how low that is relative to the, you know, the rest of the area, the rest of the state, which overall has a pretty high, almost double, you know, household income. not to harp on the city, but just to point out that, you know, the funds that we have to work with when people are questioning, you know, why we don't have this or we don't have that, if all the things that we have are based on tax dollars, your median household income is a pretty important thing to be aware of. Well, over the last month or so, people have been calling me on it, and I have no idea what I'm talking about, that I'm way off. It's like more than double what I've been throwing out there. And I haven't been able to figure out why people believe this to be the case until this week, when I noticed that, or someone pointed out to me, actually, that in the most recent Economic Development Office newsletter that gets emailed, I think it came out on the 8th of this month, it states the area family median family income as $72,000. And then somewhere else online, I found a presentation that from the Economic Development Office, an overview of the city, that has the median household income at like 71 and change or something like that. The median family is 71 and change. And they admit that their estimates for, you know, adjusted off of the 2000 census number for, you know, 2006 or 2007, monetary adjustments, but the numbers are just completely made up. You know, the one from the email, they call it the area median family income, which isn't actually a figure. I mean, if you get the Census Bureau, you have state, city, county, or county, city. You don't have an area. You know, there is no such animal, which in that number doesn't exist, that they have, doesn't exist anywhere. So it would lead one to believe that they're kind of cherry-picking which communities they want to consider to be part of the Worcester area, and, you know, which gives them that high number. But that number is at least 20,000 above what our actual median family income is, which is essentially just making stuff up. You know, it's not a good number to be making up, because it's one of those numbers that really, I mean, if people hear what our median household income actually is, it's one of those things that will get people to realize we've got a lot of work to do around here, good work to do around here. But you throw out there that we have a median family income that's similar to Sherburne Falls. That's a dangerous thing to be placing in people's minds. And I don't know that it was done intentionally, because, again, the language is a little funny on the email. The PowerPoint presentation that I found that has it listed equally as high, or almost as high, it's very vague and does make it sound like it's the actual city family, median family income. So it may have been intentional there, but I can't imagine there's some nefarious scheme at hand to, you know, it convince everyone in Worcester that we're worth a lot more than we actually are. But going into what we all know is going to be a troubling tax year for the budget, and monetary issues, what they are in the city, it seems like a pretty dangerous road to be traveling, where we're essentially just making up our overall value. So, yeah, that's it. I thought it was kind of hilarious. But I felt better knowing that it was not me that was totally wrong with the median household income. It was the city of Worcester, and, you know, misinforming a lot of their own employees and whatnot, who tended to be the people who were telling me what I was talking about, folks who actually catch a check from the city of Worcester.
Well, thanks, sir. You know, I want to say thanks for bringing that up, too. There's an article today in the Telegram and Gazette about the political blogosphere, and it's just the same. It's just basically what you would expect it to be. It's not that great, but I think this is an example of where, you know, the average citizen who knows how to type can have some influence on the debate, can bring some actual information in there, can clarify some stuff. I'm going to play an interview that I did with Pat Moriarty about WCUW, Worcester's community radio station, which has had some tough times this year, and Pat talks a little bit about that. And then we'll come back with some responses to stuff that we have talked about on the show.
Well, Pat Moriarty.
Yes, Mike.
What's going on with WCUW these days?
Well, actually, a lot of things. It things really seem to be looking up there. So, let's see. In July, I think a bunch of people got together and made a special election happen.
Okay.
And elected a almost completely new board. I think for a number of years, things were kind of stagnant there. You know, nothing was really happening.
Okay.
And this is a bunch of people really kind of committed to making things happen. So that's good. I think it's a really good community resource, and it could become a lot more community-oriented, which I think is where we're headed.
Well, I like that idea, because I know that I've never tried to get involved, but I know people in recent years who've tried to get involved who felt like there was more of a barrier maybe than there needed to
be. Right. Yeah, I think so too. Oh, I suppose I should say at some point that I'm not like an official spokesperson or anything from CUW.
Wait, how long have you been involved?
Geez, over 20 years.
Okay.
I think I might have started in 86.
All right. Does that make you an old-timer there, or are there a lot of people?
There are people who have been there longer.
Wow.
But, you know, not that many.
Uh-huh.
So, but, yeah, I've heard some talk of like a programming committee, okay. Which would be nice. I mean... Just to have a group of people dedicated to dealing with programming, you know, people who want to do shows,
mm-hmm.
And just what goes out over the airwaves, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I hope that happens, and it looks like it will. And the new board, you know, their hearts seem to be in the right place, which is good.
Okay.
Our production studio got pretty destroyed when our roof leaked. Right into it.
Yeah.
And right now, a few people have been fixing it up. We got a bunch of new, I say new equipment, new to us, but a public radio station, you know, got better equipment, and they gave us all their old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's digital, and I mean, when I used to do production, it was, you know, you splice the tape, cut it, splice it together, and I mean, that was fine, but...
How do you like the digital? Have you played with
it? I've just
much?
Fooled around with it a little bit, and it's amazing. I mean, you can replace a note in a guitar solo if you want to, you know,
uh-huh.
or take one out. A friend of mine works at a big classical station in Ireland, and she's a producer. She sat me down at the computer and said, hey, go ahead, have fun. It's pretty amazing, so I'm really looking forward to that.
How are things... Are things still in financial crisis over there? It seemed like earlier
Well, you
this
know,
year.
Things have always been in financial crisis
okay.
ever since I've been there. It's,
all right.
You kind of live from fundraiser to fundraiser.
Okay.
We have a few underwriters, which helps a lot, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's we've never had to shut down for lack of money, though. It's probably gotten close a few times. So, yeah, I think we're having another fundraiser next month sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also now like a kind of a fundraising committee, so planning the fundraisers helps.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm hoping that it's gonna keep heading upwards, you know. And like I said, I really would like to see more community orientation, and I know other people there would too. So the production studio will help that a lot, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of just. Tell you what our call letters are so people know it's
laid out.
It's WCUW 91.3 FM, and it's right here in Worcester.
And what time is your show?
I have two shows. Monday nights from 5 to 8, which is a folk music show, and on every other Sunday morning, I do like a traditional Celtic show. That's from 9 to 11.
Pat Moriarty, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for talking to me, Mike.
So now I want to talk about some responses to stuff that we've done on the show or some connections to little stories that we've covered in the past. First of all, Lincoln Estate Elm Park Neighborhood Association website continues to be completely unprofessional and talk a lot about their beef with Bob Barassa, who used to run the website. And here's a post from January 14th where they're basically complaining they're basically accusing him of internet harassment and because apparently he's been posting bad comments on their blog that they've been deleting. This seems like completely ridiculous to me just because, like, I think anybody who runs a blog, I mean, you're probably getting 1,000 comments a day, which are all for, like, you know, porn and whatever, porn and drugs, basically. So I'm actually going to say that your Bob Barassa harassing comments are probably the least offensive comments that you're getting day to day on your blog. I don't know.
And can be easily dealt with. You know, I mean, it's not like we haven't figured out a way to eliminate unwanted persons from a web property. You know, encouragement is not one of them.
Anyway, it's obviously ridiculous that, you know, if you have this feud with a guy, just like do something with your neighbor. Don't make it look like your neighborhood association is just obsessed with this one guy. Like people look at your website and they think all you care about is Bob Barassa. And parking around Becker. Finally, they have a post about parking around Becker, which is probably the number one thing that they're concerned about. But the website doesn't make it look like that. It makes it look like that's a distant second. So, second of all, I wanted to have, here's a great response that, Jeff Barnard posted. to the commentary last week about how David Hitch was possibly the worst editorial cartoonist in the country. And he says, I realize that I haven't actually laughed at a David Hitch cartoon in so long that maybe I had become inured to the lowered bar. Now I wonder, have I ever actually laughed at a David Hitch cartoon? So thanks, Jeff. Thanks for looking and researching that issue. Third of all, Anthony Mora has a response on his blog. He has a third part of the Grace Ross series about how Grace Ross is a Zionist stooge. And this one is called Grace Ross 3, Better Option Than Concessions, Arrest Zionists Behind 9/11. The cool thing is he refers to us as a radio show a couple of times in here, so that's kind of cool. I like that. I like the idea of pretending to be a radio host.
Mike, you have to make sure that the link is available for his blog. So after we talked about last time, I went and looked it up, and I was astounded at just how out of control the general language and tone of this website is. So off the charts in terms of utter insanity, it's almost hard to wrap your head around. Like, you can't, it's the sort of insanity you can't just wrap, you can't explain to somebody. There's like 50 years of intertwined, intermingled conspiracy that all seems to revolve around the General Milbury Street area. And I mean, like intergalactic conspiracy that is the hub of which is Milbury Street. Which says a lot for Milbury Street, or says absolutely nothing for Anthony Mora, but it's a really, really interesting read. And everybody in the city of Worcester that has a computer has to spend some time on his website.
The trouble
with flip your lid. It'll absolutely flip your lid.
This morning, his Blogspot account seems to be screwed up, and like the dates are wrong and stuff. Like I can't find. I'm looking at this on an RSS reader though, so I do have a copy of this. His tone is really, I mean, to us, his tone is really nice. Like, he doesn't accuse you and I of being Nazis or Zionists or John Birch people or whatever. But he says, unlike these local...
We're the only people he hasn't accused of that.
It's true. Well, and I appreciate that, because I think we should keep this, he says, unlike these local radio hosts, I do not want to call someone a nut or a stooge unless I know that to be the case. We have everything to gain, however, from examining the fruits of Ross's labors as well as her alliances. And I have to say, like, I guess I have two... Mr. Mora, like, here are my two responses to your blog post. Number one, I think that the Green Party should have taken this stuff about Israel and Palestine out of their public statements, whether people in the Green Party agree with them or not, because I think it's a huge distraction for a party which has good things to say on a state and local level and is not going to win any elections by talking about international issues. I haven't been involved with Green Party decision-making in several years now, but I'll tell you, when I was involved with it, I really had the sense that, like, people would just kind of hijack it for their own little project, and it's not clear to me that Israel or Darfur or whatever is a big deal to your average Green Party registered person in Massachusetts, that they may not agree with us or disagree with us or know anything about this stuff. Like, it seems to me like this is totally just does not belong on their agenda in the state. The second thing I would say is that, you know, my feeling that this website is nutty is basically because I don't think that the Zionism is behind everything. You know, I don't think that back in the 50s when Mr. Mora thought communism was behind everything, that communism was behind everything. Like, you know, there are many Jews in the world and they're organized, but they're not running everything. They're not that powerful. Like, you might as well say, like, the Catholics, my people, we have way more people and we're way better organized, you know, and we don't run everything. The Muslims, divided but pretty well organized and way more, you know, way more powerful than the Jews, they don't run everything. Nobody runs everything. There isn't this. So conspiracy theories are fun, but I don't think conspiracy theories can be taken seriously as like the as part of a political discussion. I don't know.
This guy's run political campaigns based on conspiracy theories. I mean, it appears as though that, like, the way that we are talking about Mr. Mira, and I'm sure he's a nice guy. I mean, whatever. The way that we're talking about him right now, I mean, on his own website, he's posted, like, responses from the Telegram and Gazette that you can tell their editorial, like, after he wrote them letters that were just as nutty. And you can tell that in their editorial office, they were having the exact same conversation that we're having right now 30 years ago. Like, this isn't anything new. The guy is, like, wrapped up in that essentially everything since World War II has been, like, this crazy, crazy conspiracy that a handful of Jews have been running us all, and we just don't know it. Well, apparently there's a handful of people on Milbury Street that know it, but nobody else knows it. And it's just some really, really insane stuff. I mean, so over the top.
I wanted to bring up the issue of the Blackstone River and this, you know, the Worcester trying to do this civil disobedience thing of not treating its water because it's going to be very expensive to treat the water, and instead paying fines. And Colin Novick, I think, had a nice editorial in Worcester Magazine yesterday where he just basically said, you know what, like, let's actually try to figure something out on this. Let's not just give up. He doesn't have any good specific stuff in here, unfortunately, but I do appreciate that. And he does point out that, you know, if the city wants to be a green city and reap the benefits from that, this is like the exact opposite. You know, this is just saying we're not going to do it. And I, you know, again, I don't know, like, I don't know how financially this can be done. I don't know what the clever things that can be done are, but it does seem like I don't know. It seems like as far as political leadership goes, it would be great if the city councilors were not like jumping to civil disobedience so fast.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm all in favor of civil disobedience. Let's just pick the right thing to be disobedient over. I mean, I said that last time we just spoke about this. I'm just not convinced. This is the thing that we want. If we're going to hit cherry, but we're going to be disobedient over and not be universally disobedient, this isn't it. And the thing that's so silly is that, I mean, we're arguing about it not being an unfunded mandate. Where do they think, if it was funded, where does anyone think the funds would come from? That, like, you know, that the federal government is actually, like, a magic money-making machine, that, like, the money just appears out of nowhere? It's still our own tax dollars. So, like, whether we pay for it now, we pay for it, you know, through fines, or we pay for it, you know, a billion years from now, somebody on the local level still needs to come up with a creative way to make sure the funds are there.
I just want to say, like, I haven't, you know, on the infusion of enthusiasm side, I'm totally enthusiastic about the city trying to figure out something constructive to do about this water treatment. On the I'm just going to have a podcast and complain about things side, I just want to complain about Clive McFarlane's column about this, because he talks about, okay, so he makes this comparison between the city, like, not paying this fine, and he says something about Abby Hoffman and the Chicago 7. And I have to say, I appreciate the effort to have a local Worcester reference, but this is the complete wrong comparison. This is the wrong metaphor here. You should be bringing up Thoreau, man. Thoreau and his, like, not wanting to pay taxes and basically starting the modern concept of civil disobedience. Thoreau, New England, he doesn't want to pay money to the government for something he doesn't like, etc. It's a perfect comparison. This Abby Hoffman thing, man, I just want to tell people out there, because if Clive McFarlane is confused about this, maybe other people are. The Chicago 7 was not like a political action. It wasn't like this week we did an interview with our local resident Tom Lewis. He did the Catonsville 9 back in the late 60s. The Catonsville 9 was like 9 people who came together and said, we're going to do a thing, right? The Chicago 7 was, you know, after the riots in around the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968, the police riots and the demonstrator riots, the powers that be said, we're going to round up some leaders and, like, throw them in jail. So they basically picked 8 people, and Bobby Seale, I believe, was tried separately, right? And this wasn't a real criminal conspiracy. They tried to throw them in jail for it, but, like, these people, Dave Dellinger in his autobiography, I think, said hadn't even met most of these guys before they showed up, before the trial, right? So, like, it's not – the Chicago 7 – like, what the Chicago 7 did was they had a really entertaining trial. Like, I know there's a movie coming out and that Borat is playing Abby Hoffman. If you haven't read about the Chicago 7, my friends out there, you should read about this because it's a great trial. There was a wonderful Jerry Rubin anecdote where he talked about how he said, one night we stayed up late coming up with a plan on how to disrupt the trial the next day. He said, apparently Abby stayed up even later than me, because the next day they walk in and, you know, they'd been going back and forth a lot with the judge, right? Like, you know, especially because the judge's last name was Hoffman, and Abby Hoffman, so not a relation, but kept, like, cursing at him in Yiddish and really, like, playing, you know, playing the Jew card a lot. Like, and so they come in one day, and the next day, and Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin are both wearing judge's robes just to piss off the judge, right? So the judge has them seized and has the robes removed. And under his robe, Abby Hoffman is wearing a Chicago Police Department uniform. So that's what I'm talking about, people. It's a great trial. It's a great, basically a great comedy routine, kind of like a Marx Brothers movie, but not something that's comparable, not something that's about civil disobedience, not something that's about non-payment of taxes.
I think Clive is just hoping that by if we start mentioning Abby Hoffman again on a regular basis, that maybe we'll get some attention once Sacha Baron Cohen's role in the film is all wrapped up. You know, now that Abby Hoffman is dead, I don't don't think, I think folks in Worcester, you know, feel left out of that whole story, so they like to latch onto it as much as possible. Yeah, so maybe Clive is just doing some early PR for us, but otherwise it's by far the worst analogy possible.
Anyhow, I just wanted to bring that up because I actually am like totally interested in these things, and it's one of these deals where, you know, you read in stuff in the paper that you know about and it's wrong and you get frustrated. Anyhow, not
well,
a big deal.
There's a great there's some really great stuff on the Chicago 7, and I just watched this last week, but the U.S. versus John Lennon documentary that came out a couple years back. Someone let me borrow it, and it's most of the movie, you know, is all revolving around the Chicago 7 and John Lennon's involvement with them. But there's some really great stuff.
Excellent.
You know, like real footage, documentary footage and whatnot in that film, and I think that came out in 2005 or 2006.
Oh, I'll totally check that out then, because I haven't seen any documentary footage of the trial itself. I'm very curious to see that. I'm just going to throw this out there because I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes, that apparently Barack Obama's head speechwriter is a Holy Cross alum, and there's a nice article about it in Newsweek a couple weeks ago.
That someone pointed that out to me. I mean, it's a really great story, and it seems like it doesn't seem like your typical like contrived like political like rise through political ranks and whatnot. It really, the way the story reads, like these two guys literally met each other when they both kind of knew nobody in D.C. and hit it off.
And my final thing I wanted to bring up is that I'm going to be volunteering at Happy Birthday Mike Leslie, 420 Pleasant Street, on January the 23rd, which is on Wednesday. And I'll be there from like 4:30 to 7:30 or something. So if people want to come by, want to choose to come by the store, I'm going to have my audio recorder there. And if people want to complain about the city or say good things about the city, give us an infusion of enthusiasm, I'll be using that material in next week's podcast.
Can we complain about other cities? About other cities as well?
People can say whatever they want. I feel like it's important to try to stay positive sometimes, just because it's too easy to be negative. My feeling is government is kind of a necessary evil. So like you're always going to have negative things. Like the government is not going to be this great thing. Like it's very rare that you're going to have a government you're excited. So if all we do is talk about, you know, the city government, you're always going to end up being negative. Like there's so much great stuff in the city, and I feel like in commentary in general forgets about that. It focuses too much on the legislative stuff, which is no fun at all, and not enough on the, I don't know. I guess people don't necessarily want to hear like, oh, I had a great day today, there's a beautiful rainbow, but that's really...
No, but there's always more happening on an individual and on a level that has nothing to, that is so far removed from you know, political circles that it is almost all universally good. And you're right, it always gets overshadowed because it's too easy to harp on the silly mistakes and the slow things that are done by, you know, within city political circles.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that, I know that there's some young people who hang out down there who know nothing about city politics, so I'm totally interested to hear what these guys are excited about in the city, because I feel like they don't have the same blinders that I tend to have about the way things work around here.
Just a jilted lover at this point.
There you go. Well, Brendan, thanks for being on the show.
No, thank you, sir. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you.